So welcome to this week's Midweek Podcast. I'm here with the Red Pill Junkie and Joshua Cutchin. Hey, guys.
Greetings.
Salutations.
And there's a few things I want to talk about tonight. And interestingly, the first one is only marginally connected to the paranormal. Have either of you seen the new Poltergeist movie?
Oh, God,
I have not
no.
yet.
Oh. It's not good, so don't get your hopes up. I rented it from Netflix because I figured, what the hell, I'll check it out. And, you know, it actually had potential in that, you know, the old Poltergeist movie, the big thing was, you know, they moved the graveyard, but they left the bodies.
Right.
And that was the big spoil, the big, oh my God, at the end. Well, everyone knew that. So they didn't really hide it in this one. This one is so packed full of CGI, it's ridiculous.
Mm. Oh, man.
So by 20 minutes in, you know, all this crazy stuff is happening, and it just keeps happening for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, CG is the death of horror. Whenever you see too much CG in a horror film, it's usually a horrible sign.
Yeah, and it's... It, but the thing is, like, it was almost entertaining because it was so over the top.
Mm.
And part of me kept saying, you know, they kept having all this electrical stuff go on, which they had in the original a little, but this was, like, really massive, like, electrical surges and all this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, you know, and they kept saying, oh, they're here and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, what if they throw this really cool twist in and these aren't dead people?
Ah.
And I'm thinking that would make this awesome. Except no, it was dead
of
people.
Of course. Yeah.
And I'm as I'm watching it, you know, it's kind of similar to the original. You know, it's these dead people from the graveyard, and the guy, the medium there, is saying, "Well, they need your daughter to find the light."
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm sitting back and I'm thinking about this. I'm like, should this type of thing even happen in 2016? Like in when the original came out in 82, that was an okay theme. The concept of an entire graveyard full of people not being able to find the light because their gravestones had been moved.
Yeah. I mean, but at the same time, I mean, it's not, I mean, much stupider stuff gets a pass from movie-going audiences.
That's true. I'm just thinking, you know, they had the opportunity where they really could have thrown a different twist on this and made it kind of cool. And I think maybe that's why I was actually enjoying it, going, what if? What if they... No, they didn't do it. All right, well...
You know, it's kind of funny that before we started recording, we were talking about, you know, the value of cover bands and the value of song covers and, you know, which ones are worthwhile. And I feel like, you know, remakes of films are much the same way.
Yes, that's actually what made me think
of
it.
Yeah, so... Yeah, and if you're gonna like go ahead and reinvent something, make it a little bit different and new. If you have to remake Poltergeist, like go ahead and switch it up a little bit, guys.
Sure.
And the thing is, I think the paranormal audience in general is so much more educated about this stuff than they were in 1982. It seems like it should have been updated a little.
I don't know. I mean, I have such a fond place in my heart for Poltergeist, for any 1980s Spielberg movie. Well, any Spielberg movie. And I think that he definitely is my favorite director of all time. And Poltergeist is definitely one of the movies that whenever I see it on TNT, I definitely will see it. We'll watch it once again. I mean, I still think it holds up. I mean...
Okay, oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Cheesy special effects, but the thing with Spielberg is that he has a great sense of when to make the reveals, and the creepy parts in Poltergeist doesn't really need special effects. It's just the ambience that Spielberg makes with the great. You know, soundtrack and the camera edition and all of that. So yeah, that's why when I saw that they were going to make a new version of Poltergeist, was like, you know, is there nothing sacred anymore?
Yeah, and like cover songs, if you're going to take it, do something different with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes it works. Sometimes you'll get, you know, okay, like look at the original Thing from Outer Space.
Yeah.
It was an okay movie. Yeah. And then you watch The Thing that John Carpenter did, and he took that and just ran with it, and it was incredible. Yeah. There was a good remake.
Great. Yeah. Or another one that comes to mind, not of the horror genre, but the Coen Brothers remake of True Grit, which handled a little bit closer to the book and was just, in a lot of ways, fundamentally different. I think that's the way to go. Like, you know, riff on it a little bit. But when you have something like Poltergeist, which has so much of it is iconic. I mean, the medium. Yeah. I can't remember the actress's name, but the medium in that is such a distinct presence.
Yeah, this house is clean.
Exactly. Or my favorite moment where she goes, "And there are others. You call him the Beast." it's a moment that, like, every time I hear it, I just get chills. such a unique presence that, like, if you're gonna replace that, and they actually gender swapped her, didn't they? It's an Irish guy. Yes. Yeah. You have to.
And he was okay for what he was doing, but it didn't compare to her at all.
Yeah, you have to get a real presence in there to make that even, you know, slightly comparable.
Well, this guy was a reality TV show star who actually had an ability to talk to spirits.
Mm.
But they flat out admit during it that he fakes most of the stuff on TV.
Mm.
So, but yeah, I...
Interesting.
You know, and just one quick aside, the movie 12 Monkeys, which I thought was a great movie, they redid it as a TV series. And the TV series might actually be better than the movie.
I've heard that.
The TV series is crazy. Like, it started out and I went, okay, how are you going to turn this into a TV? It has the same premise, but then it goes in a completely different direction with it. And it's just really, like, it breaks your brain trying to figure out what's going on.
Another example of a remake, well, of a TV series in this case, is obviously Galactica, and then Battlestar Galactica, and then Galactica BSG, which I thought was amazing in every sense, you know.
See, I liked it at first. I did not like where they went with it, but I would agree it was a great remake.
I mean, the feel. What I loved about the series, well, it had great characters, right? You know, you got engaged because you were interested in what happened to the characters. You know, where did they come from? Where were they going? And also, what I felt is that Galactica really captured the zeitgeist of those years, right? The years right after 9/11, the years in which you didn't know, or the people were scared that, you know, they had enemies infiltrated, you know, just like the Cylons. And then, well, what are you going to do? Well, obviously, then you start to do what it takes to survive. And that probably means, you know, betraying the very cornerstone by which your society was founded. And that really was very interesting to see in popular television.
Absolutely. And the original, of course, was also inspired by the whole ancient alien idea.
And Mormonism.
And what?
I think, if not Mormonism, no, yeah, it was the idea of Cabal and all of that, the Lords of Cabal. It had a lot of... based on the religion of Mormonism, you know, the Book of Mormon.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I did not know.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, oh. I mean, because the idea is that that eventually, for the Mormons, that they are going to become like the gods of their own planet.
But no, it definitely makes sense. Now that you mentioned it, I just wasn't aware that that was an mm-hmm. inspiration.
Yep.
But speaking of ancient aliens, we can segue into this. I just, as we were getting started here, this popped up on my phone as I ran a quick cleaner on it as an ad. Ancient Aliens the Game. An exciting new free-to-play adventure game from the A&E Television Networks based on history's hit TV series, Ancient Aliens. It says, play as a reluctant alien hybrid in this climactic, story-driven city-building game written by best-selling author and award-winning game writer Stephen Elliott Altman. Uncover evidence along with ancient astronaut theorists and learn the truth from the aliens themselves. Abduct primitive humans, manipulate their DNA, and help them establish modern civilization as you exploit Earth's mineral wealth and oversee the construction of the Great Pyramid of Giza.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Makes me want to cry.
You know, as a seasoned gamer, that kind of offends me.
Why?
Well, because there are already a whole bunch of really, really good games that have something to do with the ancient alien premise. But for example, Halo, right? You know, which is probably one of the most popular video games of all time. And one of the premises is that this ancient alien civilization, the Forerunners, pretty much like engineer the human race. That's one of the basic premises of the video game. There's also Assassin's Creed, which is a great video game series, and there's a lot of interesting correlations with the ancient alien theory, or actually not the ancient alien theory, but more like in the vein of Graham Hancock's, you know, first civilization. You know, there's this first,
really?
yeah there's this first civilization that reached a high level of technology, but then they got like decimated by, interestingly enough, a major solar flare, you know, and that's just like the one of the elements in the plot line, you know, the plot of the whole game.
Huh. I had no idea.
See, I would love to see an Ancient Aliens game where it's tied in and it brings you to a random Wikipedia article, and you have to come up with a way to tie Ancient Aliens into that subject. So it's, so, you know, so it's like you know, the steam locomotive. Well, ancient alien theorists contend that the steam locomotive was based on blueprints found in ancient Sumer. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh man. All right. There was this thing we were trying to record a couple weeks ago, and Mike kept dropping out, and we were having all kinds of problems. But I wanted to read this, and because I thought this was just very profound in a way, considering paranormal type stuff. It came off of a Tumblr called Just Shower Thoughts. Did you fall asleep, Miguel? Is everything okay?
Sorry, I hit my microphone.
It's a Tumblr called Just Shower Thoughts, and it says, and what it is, it's a collection of just things that people have come up with. Some of them kind of profound, some of them just kind of silly and funny. And they're collected on this Tumblr. And this one says, most animals don't recognize their own reflection because their brains aren't complex enough. I wonder if humans have observed something we cannot comprehend, or even know we cannot comprehend, because our brains lack that complexity. And is that what's really happening when we have these paranormal experiences? Are our brains just not capable of understanding what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, that's almost like a thumbnail credo for, you know, a lot of the views that I have come around to in this current season of my life. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, I feel that whenever you have something truly out of your normal frame of reference, your brain is, you know, desperately trying to put it on a mental box, you know, and that's the thing that Greg Bishop has been proposing for for a number of years now, and I think that he definitely is on the right track, because that's the way the human mind works, out of a need for efficiency, a need, you know, that's part of our evolutionary development, you know, the thing that in which our species had to develop in order to survive, you know, in a world full of dangers and predators, you know, in which you really need to try to trigger the fight or flight survival mode as quickly as possible. And that's why, you know, you come up with ways in which you probably misinterpret a lot of weird things that you know, stick out of quote unquote normal experiences.
Yeah. No, I saved that one because I just thought it was so perfect. Yeah. Also, something else I scribbled down real quick. Whitley Strieber has a book out called Hunters that they made into a TV series.
Oh, I do remember hearing about that.
Yeah, and the TV series so far is interesting. I'm not going to say it's amazing. I mean, it's kind of depending on where it goes. I've been watching it every week and not going, I guess I'll watch that.
What's the premise?
It's a little hard to figure out. Okay. That's the thing.
Interesting.
The general premise seems to be that a long time ago, these aliens, possibly running from some kind of mass slaughter, crash-landed here, and they're able to take our form, but they have to kill someone to steal their form. And so they've been hiding amongst people. And now something is coming called the Purge. And the government thinks it's they're going to attack humans and try to take over the planet, but others are saying no, this is when they're going to leave the planet and go back home. But one of the concepts they threw out here is that they were talking about some religion, someone I think who was religious or whatever, and that's what it was. When someone was finally being told that these aliens are here, they're like, it's going to completely ruin your religious views and this and that. Because one of the main characters is Mormon. And what it made me wonder is, does a belief in aliens really conflict with religious views of God?
No. As a Catholic, well, as a former Catholic, you know, a person who was raised on a Catholic family here in Mexico, who went to school to private Catholic schools, I can tell you that, yeah, it can, because when you start to question some of the things that are in the Bible, and then, well, started to try to see if you can frame that on a different light. For example, many of the things in the New Testament, and maybe even the things on the Old Testament, and you say, well, maybe that column of fire that is that was leading the Hebrews through the desert, well, maybe that was some kind of like UFO, you know, go much in the vein of the ancient aliens. And I don't know, that it seems that people have only so much space in their minds for out of the ordinary beliefs, and if that space is already occupied by things like God and angels and devils and whatnot, then there's really not much place left for things like ghosts, reincarnation, and aliens and things like that. You know, I mean, I can't really tell you how many times I have had very heated discussions with people over this, you know, trying myself to try to propose these ideas, and people who I knew that they went to church every Sunday morning to pray to this invisible man in the sky, No, they thought my interest in the UFOs was complete nonsense.
Hmm. Well, I can see that, but what if, if we found extraterrestrial life, do you think it would really mess up people's belief in God that much? It seems like the Vatican, if I remember right, the Vatican came out and said that extraterrestrial life doesn't conflict with the Bible.
The people whose lives it would ruin were missing the point in the first place, is the way that I feel.
How so?
Yeah.
In the sense that they're following things so literally that they're missing the larger truths at play in any world religions. But just coming from my own standpoint, in Christianity, for example, if you're that dogmatic about the literal nature of the Bible, then I think you are missing the point, because it reminds me of something that that Patrick Harper talks about in Demonic Reality. It's been a couple of months since I've mentioned that, right? where he talks about how sometimes fictions can be the truest things, in the sense that you might be watching a film that's a love story, and the emotions and the way that's represented in there are some of the truest things. The depiction of that relationship is like true, and it speaks to you on a deep symbolic level. If you've ever been in love, is it a literally true story about these two people? No, it's fictionalization. And I feel that a lot of religious texts are like this too. Things can be true and not be literally true. Yeah. I deal with a lot of cognitive dissonance, in being interested in these subjects and also being a Christian. But I think I said this off air to you guys. Like, I find it mind boggling that a lot of the religious establishment will be quick to say the Lord works in mysterious ways, but but when it comes to mysterious things, he doesn't have a hand in it at all. and at the end of the day, like, I feel like if you let something like the discovery of alien life undermine your faith, then you were sort of missing the point in the first place, because if you believe in a supreme creator being, you have to acknowledge the fact that they are completely in control of the universe. And so even if it goes against something that was that your particular faith has said is impossible, well, at the end of the day, using your logic, you should be able to say, well, however or why ever this exists, it fits into the creator's scheme, if that makes sense.
Yep.
And in a sense, it is therefore, as part of creation, it is holy by default. But again, like, I did mention this on the Fairy Faith documentary. I find it so frustrating that Christian cosmology especially is willing to address a host of benevolent entities and a host of malevolent entities, but has no room in between for things that are neither good nor evil. I don't understand that sort of line of thinking at all. And I think that if we could all people of faith could engage in a little bit more nuance and be a little bit more comfortable sitting with ambiguity, then it would make the world a better place.
I would like to say two things. One, before I forget, one is that I remember reading in Whitley Strieber's Communion how when he was starting to deal with all this stuff that he started to sense in his life, this intrusion of what he calls the visitors in his life. And as a devout Catholic, he went to try to have a talk to a priest about his fears about all these things, whether they were demons or not. I remember reading how this priest said to him, it didn't matter what they were or where they came from, they will only serve to increase God's glory. And that's something that gave at that time to Wheatley a lot of comfort. And the other thing I just forgot. Oh, no. Here it is. Interestingly enough, last week, as I was like kind of preparing myself to have a talk with Adam Sane for his Conspiranormal podcast, I decided to rewatch the TV movie The UFO Incident on YouTube, which I feel it's a great movie, even though it was made for TV, you know, with James Earl Jones, Estelle Parsons, and Barnard Hughes. I actually believe it is one of James Earl Jones's finest interpretations and performances as an actor. You know, when he is playing the part of Barney, you know, Barney Hill, and when he is under hypnosis and recalling, you know, whatever happened to him and his wife Betty, when they were allegedly abducted by non-human entities, and you know, when he goes into a state of complete terror and he's screaming, "I gotta get my gun," and all of that, and Dr. Simon is trying to call him down, but then there comes a part when Barney allegedly says, you know, maybe, you know, by going to another planet, you know, with these beings, it would somehow prove the existence of God, you know, which for him was a very like moving and disarming thought. So yeah, like Joshua said, you know, some people have this interpretation or this belief in a deity that to me is just so annoyingly small. You know, so diminutive, because I do happen to believe in some kind of deity, but my deity is one that, you know, imagines multiverses, you know, every second, you know. So I don't know. I mean, some people still want to believe in this tiny god who is, you know, created this world in 6 days, and that's that. Whereas, you know, science and other religions, you know, especially Hinduism, you know, have give a much more interesting, a much more, you know, grandeur vision of a cosmos and of a deity that is, you know, not limited by our own limitations in imagination.
All this talk sort of reminds me of my father had a classmate from college who ended up interviewing for the presidency of that particular college, and it was a Christian school. And at one point in the interview, they asked him, you know, how big is your God? And he had like the best reply ever, which was, "If I could tell you how big my God was, he wouldn't be my God." which I think is probably the craftiest way of getting out of it. But yeah, I mean, you know, in summation of this entire subject, I think that if people are adaptable, and if they've been engaging in, you know, this sort of cafeteria-style syncretism that I particularly favor, it's not a problem, because you'll bend and not break in your views. Now, of course, I'm sure that there are plenty of Christians out there who would say that I'm being a bad Christian for doing that, but, you know, this is my truth. This is the way that my world works. So I think that there would be some people who would lose their minds, but I think that there would be plenty of other people who would just fold it into the way that they see the universe.
Yeah, yeah. I've always liked the way that the Seth material presented God as the all that is. So everything that exists is God.
Yeah.
But then he took it a step further and said there was some mention that the all that is was searching for others like it.
Ah.
And like that very concept is sort of mind blowing because he put our reality as kind of like just a minor thing in the all that is, that that we're next to nothing compared to everything that's out there. You know, our whole universe. And that this thing, this consciousness that we exist as part of, was also looking for others that were like it. And to just try to imagine where it's looking for these things.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, probably by creating life in order to see whether that life will be able to evolve into the same state in which it exists.
I always got the impression he meant like outside of itself.
Mm.
Like it was looking for another that was the all that is somewhere else.
Okay.
I mean, that was the impression I took.
No, it's an interesting interpretation, you know. I mean, that's what I love about those kind of messages, you know. They are ambiguous enough that they leave room for more than one take.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's move on to this. We got actually PDF document from a listener in Sweden. And he's had a few experiences and wanted to get our take on them. He said that I am not satisfied with how traditional psychology would explain my experiences and thus, in true scientific manner, seek answers from other sources to compare. So he has a few events here. Let's see, there are six, I think. Yes, six events that we're going to cover and just get your thoughts on them and see what you guys think.
Mm-hmm.
The first one's called They Are Everywhere. And this was when he said he was between 8 and 12 years old. He said, parents came into the room. They heard me screaming in the middle of the night. I sat up in bed, eyes wide open, totally awake. They said I was almost panicking, afraid, looking all around me as I saw stuff all around me that they did not see. I kept saying, they are here, they are here. As my parents tried to comfort and calm me down, I responded to their words, but still rambling, they are here, and looking all around me as if they were moving around the room. Sooner or later, I calmed down and I fell asleep. I imagine I was calmed down and went to sleep out of exhaustion and sleepiness. I can't remember exactly how it ended on each occasion or when and why it stopped happening. I can't remember what they look like, but if I must muster an image, it would be a human-like shadow a few yards away. It was a very long time ago, and the memory is vague. My parents revealed to me, 25 years later, that it happened a few times and that they were very close to taking me to a psychologist. Before these 25 years, they just said that I had nightmares, but they never revealed any details of what I said or how I behaved. They thought it was nightmares, but as it went on, they began to grow more concerned. It went away after a while, and they never needed to get me to a doctor.
Well, that's not horrifying. yeah, so there are a couple of takeaways. I think the first thing that I would notice, and this will become clearer, I think, as we get farther through this, but even though he doesn't necessarily remember clearly the seeing the entities, this is probably the clearest that he saw things out of all his anecdotes that he provided. Which again ties into this idea that we mentioned on the Fairy Faith podcast, which was talking about how children just have an aptitude to see things, with an ease that adults tend to lack. I also think it's interesting because this reminds me of the static people anecdote from the nightmare as well. It sounds a lot like that to me.
Yeah, yeah. Miguel?
Well, I mean, I can totally relate because similar things happened to me when I was a kid. You know, I remember going to my parents' bedroom in the middle of the night and telling them that I could see like a little pixie-like entities like dancing around on the roof of my own bedroom, you know, and obviously my parents told me, well, you're just having a dream, go back to sleep. And I've always wondered, you know, whether I was seeing that. Probably it was probably some kind of like entoptic phenomena that triggered my imagination. But it was really interesting. I still kind of like remember how I started seeing these things, you know, moving around, you know, kind of like the experience related by those last witnesses in the Fairy Folk documentary, Joshua.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, it's so interesting how the, yeah, like you say, you know, the mind of a child is unbound by social stigmas and conformities. So, you know, it can go whenever it wants, and you know, yeah, it's difficult to ascertain whether there is something there aside from just the impressionable mind of a child, or whether, well, like we were saying, you know, there's a truly anomalous trigger, and the mind of the child is just trying to fill in the blanks with something that is more approachable, knowable, and in my case, it was, you know, these duendes, you know, dancing around on the roof of my bedroom, and in the case of our Swedish friend, you know, it was something that filled him with dread. You know, it wasn't a dreadful experience in my part. You know, it was, you know, it was something that I guess it made me feel that I needed to inform my parents that my room was infested with these uninvited guests.
Yeah, you know, just to be clear, there are plenty of examples of children making stuff up. I think that happens too.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, what I find is interesting is when once they become adults, they double down on and really make sure to say, no, this is something that really did happen to me. This has a tangible reality.
Hmm. And of course, because he doesn't remember it super clear, it's also it could have been a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It could have been a nightmare with some what's the word I'm looking for? That where the dream comes into your reality when you're waking up. Hypnagogic.
Right.
Yeah.
Actually, hypnagogic might be the other one. Same general idea, where he may have woken up and still had some of the dream imagery there with him as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I always find it kind of interesting. I mean, don't get me wrong. I do think that sometimes dreams are just dreams, but I always find it interesting how we have the real world and the dream world, and we automatically write dreams off as being unimportant or as being not real in some sense, you know. But just because that aspect of our perception and that aspect of our reality doesn't bleed through into our conscious alert wake stance doesn't necessarily imply that there's an importance of a hierarchy of how important or how real these experiences are, if that makes any degree of sense.
No, it does.
Good.
All right, let's move on to the second one, which seems slightly connected. This was also, what was the first one? He was between 8 and 12. This was also when he was between 8 and 12 years old. He called it protection. And he said, as a kid, I had a cuddle toy in the shape of an octopus, almost as long as myself, with eight long arms. I have clear memories of me going to bed and systematically, logically placing the octopus arms in a pattern over my quilt to protect me. Special detail was given to each and every vector of attack so that they could not get to me. The quilt and octopus was the shield. It worked. No visitations as far as I can remember. Later in my early teens, the octopus was replaced by multiple miniature models, World War II cannons, tanks, airplanes, ships, and soldiers that were on display in my room. Before going to bed, I would remember making them aim across the room in a specific crossfire pattern so that they would not be able to get me. It worked. No visitations as far as I can remember. Now, the first thing I would say there is, because he had no visitations, was it protecting him from something, or was it just a sort of an OCD kid type of thing to do?
I mean, it's to me, it sort of smells like a fetish, you know. It smells like, and not in a fetish in like the sexy fetish kind of way, folks. Sure. But I mean, like in terms of like, you know, traditional, an object that is given power. It's almost, you know, if you look at the way that. Okay, so if we assume that these experiences are tied up in consciousness and are tied up in some sort of, perhaps astral realm, use whatever term you want, then that implies that it can be somehow affected by psi phenomena, that somehow consciousness effects can interact with this phenomena. And if you look at the way that any sort of, you know, ritual magic tends to work, is it wants to get your subconscious to do the heavy lifting. And in order to do that, you sometimes have to focus on something that takes your conscious mind away from the issue and lets your subconscious do the actual work. So it's almost like having the octopus was sort of a red herring for his brain, even though he didn't realize what he was doing, probably. Almost sort of like a red herring that allowed him to his subconscious to do the sort of projection and protection that he really needed to protect himself from these entities and maybe sort of fend them off. That's one interpretation. That's sort of one that leaps to mind.
Okay, Miguel.
Well, yeah, the octopus definitely seemed to have some kind of ritualistic, you know, importance for him. You know, I mean, I agree that children tend to be highly ritualistic and also highly fetishistic, you know, in their behavior. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That is why kids tend to then get too attached with things like, you know, a favorite toy, a favorite doll, or a favorite blankie, you know, I mean. Yeah. I used to have a blankie when I was a kid, and my parents, you know, they couldn't find a way for me to get rid of it. You know, I mean, and what is that? It's an object that gives you comfort. It gives you a sense of security, and that then, you know, probably brings the mind of a child to a certain point of view or perspective. You know, it relaxes their mind. It releases anxieties, and that probably plays a part in the way they perceive the world. You know, and maybe that kind of like maybe tunes out those kind of things that seem dreadful or seem menacing. You know, so. Yeah, there's probably a reason why the ritual with the octopus ended up working the same way that, you know, if you are a child who is afraid of the dark and you then cover your head with your blankie, you know, something that's as seemingly useless as that does the trick that the child manages to go to sleep.
Okay.
Yeah.
The next one is completely different. It's called the Energy Draining American Football. And he said he was about 13 years old at the time. I must have been a teen when I got a brand new American football imported from the USA. He is in Sweden, if anyone missed that. First and last American football I ever had. It didn't take long before I accused the ball of being totally evil, an energy draining talisman or thing or call it whatever. I did not tell anybody about this. Who the F would believe in this thing? But I felt really bad and drained. Nausea, bad stomach, bad balance, and no will to do anything after playing with it. I shoved the ball into a wardrobe and left it there. Got much better in just a few days. Then, after a while, I found it again, held it, examined it, and I got worse by the minute. So I shoved it deeper into the wardrobe. From that day, I have not touched an American football ever again. Many years later, my parents called me up and asked if they should throw it away since they were cleaning out the wardrobes. Now it hopefully lies buried under tons of waste in a dump somewhere. And, you know, when I'm as we're going through these, you have to wonder if he's particularly sensitive to things, first of all.
Yeah, for sure.
And second is maybe able to project onto objects certain things. So maybe for whatever reason, this you know, clicked with him badly. And in doing so, you know, he actually projected bad energy onto it.
Sorry.
I was going to say, John, reminds me of this alleged ability of psychics, you know, that they manage to pick up either good or bad vibes from common objects. You know, who knows what was the true origin of that seemingly innocent American football, you know? I mean, I don't know. I mean, imagine if people were sensitive enough that they could pick up the despair of all those Chinese slaves who are working in sweatshops. Exactly.
Yeah.
Imagine you put on your brand new sneakers, and did you feel all the toil of that poor Chinese woman who had to work for 18 hours straight on that sweaty factory, you know? You will burn those things immediately.
Yeah. it's the great irony that anyone with a smart device is complicit in modern slave labor.
Unfortunately.
But my only retort to that is that the octopus probably was made under similar conditions and seemed to be, you know, seemed to be hunky dory with that. But I almost think of it, you know, maybe he does have the ability to project on things something like, you know, we talk about the term scapegoat, where the sins would be placed upon an animal and it would be sacrificed. Yeah. Maybe he had a skate ball.
Well, you know, it's also possible that there was nothing with the football and for some reason he just started feeling bad with it and connected it to it, but that he had enough unconscious power over his body that once he made that initial bad connection, it amplified it. You know, the football could have been fine, but then for whatever reason, he started not feeling good with the football, and he focused that feeling in on the football, and then every time he touched the football, he would feel worse and worse because deep down, he felt like it was the football doing it, and he had enough subconscious, I mean, because we all have the placebo effect.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it could be sort of a more extreme version of that as well.
The placebo effect.
Yep.
Sure, the sensory involvement of, you know, touching the pig's leather, smelling it, you know, and like you said, making the mental association, you know, of that perception, sensory perception with a bad experience. And obviously, that's something that happens to all of us, you know, it's been scientifically proven how smells manage to have a greater effect in our recollection of past events.
Yeah.
You know, this is something that Joshua touched upon, you know, on the manuscript of his soon to be published new book.
Yep, that's definitely in there. Mm-hmm. Maybe he was just picking up on the fact that football has a detrimental effect on American society as a whole.
All right, so number four, someone in the other room. He said he was approximately 24 to 29 at the time. He says, I think it occurred two times. First time I had just gone to bed and I was just about to sleep when I heard the floorboards in the other room, just a few meters from my bed, quirking. It sounded exactly like a person was trying to walk slowly, sneaking. I was super startled and thought it was a thief, maybe a neighbor, peeking inside my apartment. Had I left the front door open? Not to confront and provoke a dangerous situation, I spoke out and said, I think you got the wrong apartment. Please show your way out. I was dead silent and dead still afterwards, trying to listen at the peak of my abilities, trying to interpret every sound, measure its distance, just trying to hard as hell to listen. The sounds never stopped. Somebody was still sneaking around in the other room. Note, there was no door between my sleeping room and the other room. The sneaking sound kept coming. After what must have been ages, I concluded that no sane human, thief, neighbor, or whatever would sneak around that much without walking all around the entire apartment, in front of the opening to my room, or leave for that matter. After thousands of moments, I concluded that there was no thief in the other room, it was something else. I felt no mischief. The thing had apparently not been trying to impose harm or fear, so I spoke, okay, I'm going to sleep now, you can show yourself out, and I did fall asleep that night. Thoughts, guys?
Well.
Now, I've had that experience many, many times where I've heard someone walk into my bedroom. I think the most extreme one, I heard someone literally just walk into my bedroom, and as I opened my eyes in the dark, I thought there was an old lady standing over me.
Oh, God.
Like, for a split second, I got this image of this creepy old lady, and I literally just took a swing.
An old hack.
And, of course, there was nothing there. What was that?
An old hack.
But it wasn't touching me. It wasn't doing the, you know, I wasn't having any kind of sleep paralysis or anything. I was laying there trying to sleep, and suddenly I heard footsteps, and I kind of rolled over figuring, you know, this happens all the time. And it's like, if it's really dark, you know how your brain sort of can sometimes see things,
sure,
but you're not sure,
sure
what you're
sure.
seeing. It was one of those things, but it felt like it was right there in front of my face. And I was like, whoa. And I took a swing and there was nothing there. And I turned on the light. And of course there was nothing there and no more footsteps. At the point where I decided I was going to write a book about my experiences, I would hear footsteps constantly walking into my room over to the side of my bed. And I was always like, okay. And I think the first time it happened, I thought it was my girlfriend. And I turned the light on, and of course, there's no one in the room. There's a particular creak as you walk through the door of my bedroom. So when you step on it, it really makes a noise. And I would hear that. And it doesn't do it any other time. And at a certain point, I kind of acknowledged, okay, there's certain things I shouldn't write about. And then it stopped, and it didn't happen again.
You know, it's interesting. This is part of a subset or part of a qualifier of paranormal interactions that I really, really, really do love, which are the interactions that seem so convincing that they're written off as mundane immediately. Like, oh, well, of course there's somebody, there's a physical person in the next room, you know? When people mm-hmm. don't automatically leap to a paranormal solution and eventually find their way to that solution, I always find those to be really, really compelling interactions.
Sure.
You know, I remember when my most prominent ghost sighting, I thought it was a kid who was, you know, really enthusiastic about the Civil War and was dressed up in his Confederate grays. But as it turns out, I was able to rule that out, and I was like, wow, I guess it was something strange. So whenever it's something that seems mundane, because it's so tangible and so real, that's what you jump to. I love accounts like that. I really do.
Well, playing devil's advocate here for a second, you know, maybe it's possible that when you are in this in between state between asleep and awake, that your senses become increased, especially, you know, in the dead of night, you know, when the most of the sounds of your surroundings, you know, get turned off. So maybe what if there was some kind of like rat, you know, like moving around in the attic of his home or whatever, and that in his state of mind seemed as if it was something that was creeping right beside him, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. There is certainly a possibility.
Sure. And I'm not saying that is the correct interpretation. I'm just offering alternatives because I think that's what we should do here.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, it didn't scare him. You know, he didn't sense any fear from it or whatever. So, and it happened twice. So it's really hard to pin down what that was.
Yeah.
I know I've had a number of hypnagogic experiences where I've woken up or as I was falling asleep, heard something or whatever that, you know, after a moment I realized, okay, that was in my head.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can really creep you out.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one night, my mother, lives in the front part of the house I live in, and she can take care of herself for the most part, but she is elderly. And there was one night where I was falling asleep and I was just about her asleep and I heard her yell my name. And now I couldn't hear her. The distance between where she is and where I am, I wouldn't literally be able to hear her if she yelled for me. But in my head, I heard her yell my name like twice. And I bolted upright and I'm like, okay, that was just in my head. I was just falling asleep. But I still had to get up and go check on her, which meant waking her up. I was like, are you okay? She's like, yeah. I'm like, all right, I just heard something. I wanted to check.
Wow.
So there was, you know, likely just a, you know, one of those weird things that happens while you're falling asleep. But I've also had experiences like that where in falling asleep, I heard a loud scream and a bang. And I sat upright, and then the dog went crazy in the other room. And I came out into the other room, and I think my mother was up at the time, and I said, what's the dog barking at? She's like, I have no idea. He just started going crazy. And I thought, did he hear what I heard? Or is it just a coincidence?
Yeah, I mean, I think that... I think he probably did. I mean, I think that... I think that, like children, pets are more sensitive to these things, and I think the literature bears that out. Something that a concept that I've toyed with, which I do mention in my upcoming book as sort of a little thought experiment, is you know, a lot of times we assume that if animals or acting strange, that they're seeing something that we aren't seeing, or maybe hearing something that we aren't hearing. But you can't underestimate the importance of smell in the life of canines and felines. And since so many paranormal things do tend to have smells, I wonder sometimes if that isn't, you know, a low threshold detection method that we don't have access to simply because our noses aren't anywhere near as sensitive. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of research that people could do into looking at how pets and small animals interact with paranormal phenomena in general. Some people have written books about ghosts and pets, but I'd like to see something about other things as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. All right. So now we'll move on to number five, which was someone in the doorway. 24 to 29 years old, approximately. Same apartment as before. I had just gone to bed, and I think I had fallen asleep and woke up. There was something standing in the doorway to my bedroom looking in. I saw nothing, but felt it looking at me. I immediately appraised that there was no harm, fear, or malice intended. After looking back a long time, thinking, I just concluded that it was a person who used to, just like me, be alive. I spoke, I don't think I can help you. I don't know what you want. I live here now and I'd like to be alone, okay? I can't help you. I'm sorry. Could you please leave? I want to sleep. Slowly, the presence faded away or walked away. After a while, I concluded that it was gone and I got back to sleep. This happened to me one or two more times afterwards. I did the same routine and politely said that I couldn't help, that I lived here and wanted to be alone. I really tried to be polite. I felt that this was the most productive way in slowing the situation. I don't know if I said or thought it, you're dead, you don't live here anymore, I can't help you. When talking about this to my friend, I have but one explanation who these visitors were, and it's that they used to be people who had died but not gone away. I felt as if they tagged along when I walked home late at night.
Sure, but then that this brings us to our previous conversation about the remake of Poltergeist, Raya. You know, what if these aren't dead people walking into his room? What if these are people living in a parallel universe, you know, that is somehow intersecting with our reality, and he's able to perceive them? You know, what if there's this parallel reality in which another person, you know, lives in his apartment, or almost an exact duplicate of it, you know, and that's what's happening.
Yeah, and that could certainly be the case. Yeah, I mean, it could be someone who had died. It's hard to say one way or the other.
Yeah, it's an interesting interpretation because, I mean, it's just as valid as other things. I feel like without a really good sense of the building's history, that's a difficult thing to claim to sort of make. What I do like about these later anecdotes that he shares with us is that it really does emphasize the importance of the individual. The fact that, you know, he had some things happen to him as a young boy and had things continue to happen to him later as an older person really does emphasize the centrality of the individual to these sort of experiences. You know, I have always remarked, you know, I talked to someone just a couple of weekends ago who had seen a UFO and seen Bigfoot and seen, you know, and seen fairies. And having spoken with her at length over several days, it became very apparent to me that this was, all things considered, a relatively balanced person. I mean, perhaps more open to these subjects than many people, but by and large, a very well-balanced person, which, again, really emphasizes to me that it's not pure chance the fact that, you know, people see these sort of things. It really does have something to do with they're bringing something to the table that the rest of us don't.
And going back to that quote I had from the Just Shower Thoughts, it could be saying that our brain can't quite process.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so we're putting onto it the only thing we know, which is, hey, there's someone I can't see staring at me from the doorway. Could be a ghost. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it could be saying we simply don't have a concept of, but we can sense that energy there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of this stuff psychologists would throw away and say, well, you know, he was sleeping, so it's just some it's more hypnagogic type of stuff. He was still dreaming a bit. It's obviously possible, and it's really hard to know. I woke up once, and everything was tainted blue. It's only happened to me once. I have no idea what it was, but I got up, and I looked around the room, and everything had a blue tint to it. And I freaked out a little. I'm like, what's wrong with my eyes? Why is everything blue? And I got up and I threw some clothes on and I walked out into the other room and I'm like, I'll have to look this up on the computer. Has anyone else had this happen? And as I started walking to the computer, I went, oh, wait, it's not there anymore.
Now, when you say the tinted blue, dark blue?
Like a light blue. Like you were looking through a light blue filter.
Oh.
And I thought there was something wrong. I mean, it could have been neurological. It could have been some kind of hypnagogic thing. But, you know, it's not something you can replicate. So it's so hard to tell.
Hmm. Interesting. You know, it sort of reminds me of, my wife bought some sunglasses that filter out, they filter out blue light. You know, they're supposedly, you wear them an hour or so before you go to sleep, and that sort of helps your body produce melatonin and get your body into the right state for a restful night's sleep. And so when you take those off, if you're like wearing them, because there have been once or twice where I need to have sunglasses to mow the lawn, but I can't put my hands on my regular pair, and I've worn those. And when you take those off after wearing them in the middle of the day, everything does have this blue sheen to it. So I wonder if there isn't some sort of perhaps some sort of purely biological, you know, reason for this.
It could be. I mean, like I said, it happened once. It just freaked me out because I thought there was something physically wrong with my eyes.
Mm.
And immediately after it, I wonder if it was just a neurological thing.
How long did you feel it last?
It was probably a minute.
Wow, that's pretty long.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was long enough that it wasn't going away, and that's why I started getting really concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, let me blink my eyes a few times. Nope, everything still has a blue tint to it. What's going on? What's wrong with my eyes?
Interesting.
See, that's the type of stuff that scares me. Like, if I think there's something wrong with my eyes or something, then I'm going to get scared because, you know, I like my eyes. I like being able to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something walking into my bedroom doesn't necessarily scare me.
Yeah. It affects your quality of life. Well, that's sort of like for me. I mean, like, I found the concept of alien abduction much less terrifying when I started thinking maybe it has something to do with consciousness, because it gives me sort of a foot in the door to push back. You know, when it's little green scientists coming down who don't give a damn about you, that's when it's terrifying. You know, when it's nuts and bolts, flesh and blood. So yeah, I can totally see that. Like, you know, at least if this is a spirit walking into my room, I can somehow deal with it versus, hey, my eyes are just going right now. I'm going blind.
Yeah. You know, some people will say it's the opposite. You know, I mean, if there are scientists, you know, from outer space coming into your bedroom, flesh and blood with bodies made of matter, that brings a limitation to them, you know, a limitation to their abilities, to their powers. Whereas, you know, a non-corporeal entity that is no longer unbound by flesh and blood, you know, that probably will be a little more unnerving. You know, I mean, how do you stop a being that no longer has a body?
You're going to make it so Josh can't sleep tonight.
Oh, yeah. That's...
I can't sleep ever, anywhere. Guy, it's killing me.
So, I mean, as far as his experience of saying being in his room, you know, I mean, it could have been someone who followed him home. It could have been someone who lived there. It could have been something from another dimension. Or it could have just been some kind of hypnagogic experience. Again, without being able to replicate them, it becomes very hard to say exactly what was going on.
We can only say that it was another that he was perceiving, and it seemed really not menacing, just curious.
Right, and both this and the one before it, the one that was labeled someone in the other room, both happened in the same apartment.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be something about that area that was causing the issue.
Yeah.
And the last one is called Menace. As usual, the 24 to 29 years old, he thinks he was. As usual, I wake up in the middle of the night. As soon as I open my eyes, I know I am staring into a totally menacing and evil thing hovering above me. Its face just a foot from mine. I lay on my back, my body inside under my quilt. It's there, but all these things... But as all these things, they are invisible. The presence is strong. If I had to put a physical traits to this invisible thing, it would be almost wolf-like predator, grinning, mouthful of teeth, wanting to devour me. Note, time during this and the above happenings was not exact, nor can I tell if these sessions took 5 minutes or 1 hour. After a while, I understand that the thing can't get closer to me. It is repelled, almost like two magnets repelling each other. Me and it being the magnets. Or, as I come to understand during this session, my quilt, combined with me having total control or awareness over my body, helped me keep the protective force up. I knew that if I moved too much or exposed a body part, except my head, outside the quilt, it would be able to come closer and even touch me, get inside. What seemed like an eternity went by, the battle between me and it, silent, staring at each other. My struggle was that after a while I had to move my body because it almost hurts to lay so still for such a long time. I micro-adjusted myself to let my joints move a bit. I can't remember how it all ended that night. It must have faded away, and I must have fallen back asleep, I imagine. I can't remember if it happened again. After this, I have not had any strange things happening to me. And then afterwards he writes, I think now many years later that the quilt was not magical. It only represented what I put into it. Me truly believing that this or that protects me seems to have worked. Would it happen to me today, I would probably be more relaxed in knowing that I am in control of my space body and have the power to repel them by sheer will or just by telling them to go away. In regards to points 4, 5, and 6, the last three stories, they never occurred while having someone else in my bed, except the one time when I woke up and felt something in the doorway. My girlfriend was sleeping beside me. I didn't feel like waking her, and so I smiled and nodded toward the door, trying to convey that I was fine with its presence and the ghost could stay for a while. I went to sleep knowing that it would not disturb me. And you're both speechless.
Well, imagining the
Huh?
Imagining the experience, you know, talk about something terrifying. I mean, he describes it as wolf-like, you know, I mean, full of teeth, you know, with a snout, you know, not really human. I don't know. I imagine like some kind of... The things that always scare me is I will imagine things that are grinning and they are showing their teeth. Mm-hmm. You know, that always creeps me out. But the idea that, okay, that there's some kind of like repulsion energy between them, you know what I mean? And with magnets, as was used as a metaphor, it is the same poles that repulse each other. So it's almost like saying that him and it, whatever it was, were kind of like the same.
yeah, that's interesting. A darker side of himself?
Perhaps.
That's an amazing insight. I would have never put that together. One of the things that stands out for me, which I've been thinking about a lot, because you know me, I would love to see some of these things that we talk about on the show, I keep on hearing more and more the more I look at it. People who have regular experiences always tend to say you don't see this with your eyes; you see it. It's more of an impression. You mm-hmm. don't see this with your eyes, you see it with your heart, I think they say in the Fairy Faith documentary at one point.
Yes.
And I wish I knew what the hell that meant. I mean, I'm obviously I do in some sense, but I wish that like I had some sense of how to implement that. And this is sort of a similar situation here. He didn't really see anything, but he had an impression, and not only an impression, but a pretty distinct impression of what this was, you know, being able to say that it was sort of wolfen. And I wish that I had some sort of grasp on exactly what that sort of interpretation was, because I think it seems to me like if you can get that impression once, you probably have a good handle on what it's like to get that impression from something again.
True. And of course, again, I'm thinking a psychologist would say, well, you were just having a night terror. And, you know, there was some level of sleep paralysis, even though you could still move and you were just imagining it. Can't say they're wrong because we have no way to measure it one way or another.
Yeah.
I don't see why they both can't be right, though, you know. I don't see why
it
can't be.
True. It's also possibly could be projecting these things. He could be having a nightmare and projecting it outside of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't state whether or not this happened in the same apartment or not. It seems like it did. It must have happened in the same apartment. So there could have been some weird energy in that apartment that was either A, interacting with him, or B, causing him to have these experiences. I mean, you can be in buildings that just affect you badly. Mm-hmm. And they may have been causing some of these experiences. It doesn't sound like it was happening to him every night or anything like that. It was just a handful of times he had these experiences. But they were enough to bug him and really make him wonder what he was experiencing.
Yeah, that's my impression as well, because if that happened every time. I mean, dude, it's time to move out.
Yeah. And for the most part, it seems like he was very, you know, this one situation was the only one that affected him negatively. But maybe he had a lot of stress in his life. Like, what was going on in his life around this experience that could have manifested in that way? I mean, it could have been almost a poltergeist-like thing where he was manifesting out some stress.
Yeah, that's the real question, is the peripheral stuff that we don't normally assign importance to in these accounts.
Yeah. And I know I think the first person that really made me aware of looking at what was going around was Mike Cleland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then I started doing that more and more and going, well, damn it, look at that. In periods of changes in my life, more stuff happened.
What's that anti-structural drum that Jeff Ritzman was beating?
Yes.
I mean, what all these experiences that he shared with us seem to imply is that human beings become kind of like vulnerable whenever we enter into the sleep world. Whenever our minds go into sleep mode, it seems like almost like as if we became like beacons that attracted entities from other realms, you know, and that's when they get to notice us, or maybe that's when it's easier for them, you know, to enter our space, or maybe, you know, I don't know, take advantage of us, if that's what happens.
Yeah, well, we're kind of in that in-between state,
yeah,
that liminal state. Mm-hmm. Oh, they're definitely interesting experiences and mildly creepy in some regards.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what to make of them in aggregate.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't say, this is what's happening to you.
Yeah, I mean, that is not really our place to say.
I mean, we take these as assuming that he is telling us the truth as he knows it, and he just wanted some feedback, and I guess that's what we got for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Any other thoughts on this?
No. Thanks for sending this in. It was a very interesting read, and had some things that I hadn't quite heard before.
All right, while we were talking, I got an email from Sherilee Black, who was on the show at the beginning of the year talking about her multiple near-death experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted me to tell you, Joshua, that she is also a fan of the Fairy Faith documentary.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm glad that...
She said you might not know, but there are more Gaelic-speaking people in Canada than anywhere else in the world. Canada, particularly our Maritimes, provided a haven to preserve the old language and traditions.
I was not aware of that either. That's interesting.
So that might be how some of that whole fairy faith stuff blended over here.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm glad that people are discovering it and liking it, you know, as opposed to being like, I want an hour and a half of my life back.
Well, I think she was already a fan
of
it.
Good.
But a few people have mentioned that they enjoyed it after, you know, you brought it to their awareness.
Good.
We also had a listener up from, I think he's from Newfoundland, yes, who was saying that they have a long history of fairy lore up there.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, sort of the way that native lore sort of dovetails with the imported lore. Interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I guess that does it for this week.
Well, a pleasure as always, gentlemen.
Maybe next week we'll have Mike back.
Yay, Miss Mike.
Sure.
All right. Thank you guys so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Thanks, you guys.